And so, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for coming and attending on a Friday afternoon to our special event today with esteemed author Ezra Vogel. I'm personally quite excited to attend this event today because I, as I'm sure many of you as well, have owe a lot of our intellectual study on the topic to him and his work. So I hope that today will be a very fulfilling discussion. Before we get started, I wanted to mention briefly about the co-sponsors of the event today. The East Asia National Resource Center is a collaborative effort between Seeger Center, the GW Institute for Korean Studies, the GW Global Resources Center at the library, the East Asia Languages and Literatures Department. Am I missing anybody else? I think that's and the Language Center here at GW. And it's a organization supported by the Title VI provision of the Higher Education Act. Department of Education funds these centers to do East Asia outreach activities and to promote the study of East Asia. So we're very happy to collaborate on this event today. And I'd like to now pass on the mic to Mike Mochizuki.
Thank you very much, Richard. Thank you all for coming to this very special event. We have Professor Ezra Vogel, who's a professor emeritus at Harvard University. He is certainly one of the titans of Asian studies in the world. I first encountered Ezra through two of his books, early books, Japan's New Middle Class and Communism in Canton. He is perhaps most well known for two books, one, Japan as Number One, which was translated into many languages, including, of course, Japanese, and became a bestseller in Japan. And I remember studying in Japan at the time, and there were many advertisements for the book on television. And the other book that he's well known for is his masterpiece, which is Deng Xiaoping and the Transformation of China, which has also been translated into many languages and has been a bestseller in China. And now he has just published this book, which is destined to be a classic as well, China and Japan Facing History. And so he's also written a number of other books, including lots of edited volumes on issues of contemporary China, U.S.-Japan relations, and so forth. In addition to that, he has also served in government. During the Clinton administration, he was the national intelligence officer in charge of East Asian and Pacific affairs. This was a very tumultuous time when U.S.-Japan economic frictions were really at a high point, and he played a key part in making sure that the strategic relationship between the United States and Japan was on solid ground. And this was also the period when we were facing the nuclear crisis with North Korea. But I also want to emphasize, you know, in addition to his scholarship and his government service, what an inspirational teacher, a generous mentor he has been to so many students. I've been lucky to be one of those students. Without his support and encouragement, I would never have gone into the field of international security studies. And then Professor Vogel took me to China on my first trip back in 1991, and that opened up a lot of doors and got me really interested in Sino-Japanese relations. But the other thing that's really important is not only has he been an inspiring teacher and mentor, he brings people together. So he's brought so many people in the Asian studies field together to work together and to exchange views and learn from each other. And he's very generous in that way. And one product of this is the friendship and collaboration that I've developed with our discussant today, Professor Dajing Yang. I remember when I came to Washington, D.C., it was Professor Ezra Vogel who said, well, there's a brilliant scholar who works on China and Japan. You should meet him. He's just started teaching at George Washington University, and this is Professor Yang. Together we direct the Memory and Reconciliation Project here at the Seeger Center. And so Professor Yang will be the discussant. And I should also remind you, if you know, you probably saw the books on sale here, and Professor Vogel has been very generous to say that he's willing to sign copies of his new book. So thank you very much for coming to speak to us. We look forward to your remarks.
Well, as you know, the good side of being a teacher of having a lot of interesting students, and sometimes you learn more from your students than you teach them, and then they go on to be better scholars than you are. That's the purpose of teaching. And in the case of these two, and Mike Mochizuki knows far more about Japanese politics than I know, and Dajing has dug far, he reads the sources much better on China and Japan than I do. And he has gone into the studies in kind of a depth, and so I learned from them too. And it's a great pleasure to be here today. I've been in Washington for yesterday and today. Yesterday, at the Carnegie Center and the Suskov Foundation, I talked about post-World War II relations between the two countries. And I thought that today is a more scholarly audience, not just people who are concerned with contemporary affairs. I would try to give the broad picture that I've tried to put together. As an old person who doesn't dig as deeply as Dajing and Mike, what I've tried to do is present a broad sweep. And having been in Japan at least once a year since 1958, and having gone to China as early as 1973, and having been every year since the late 1980s, I do have kind of a perspective that comes from old age, and having been around and talking to a lot of people, and I thought that one thing an old man can do, if he can't dig so deeply, is to try to at least put the broad perspective. So when I finished the book on Deng in 2011, it was at the time when relations between China and Japan were at their worst. And I'd never really, I'm not a historian, I'm more of a contemporary sociologist by training, and I became a kind of a generalist on modern China and modern Japan, trying to look at the political system. And when I was a graduate student, one of my teachers, Talcott Parsons, was a kind who tried to see the whole social system of all different parts of politics and economics and the social structure and the underlying values, and try to see that broad picture that even when I was doing more specialized studies, I always try to keep that broader framework in mind. And so I thought what I would try to do, since China was saying that it's an issue of history and the Japanese have to study more history, I hadn't studied history, but I wanted to contribute to the two countries getting along. I had good friends in China, I had good friends in Japan, and I thought the two countries could, well, do a lot better than fighting as they were in 2010, 2012, and I'm just getting started on this book. And so that's what I decided to work on, the broad history sweep between the two countries. And I'm happy that I'm selling a few copies of my book. But what I thought is, if you've looked at the book already, you may go into more detail than I will do today. But I thought I would try to provide the broad picture today of three times when one country was really learning from the other. Because in a way, those are the deepest and most influential interactions between the two countries. And I try to think through what is the broad perspective of what was happening. So the first time when the Japanese were learning from China I date from 600 AD to 828. And why do I use those dates? It's because in 600, the Japanese sent a mission to China to go to Chang'an, the capital of the Sui dynasty, and to try to begin learning from China. And those formal missions ended in 828. So for a period, during that time period, the Japanese every 10, 20 years, I think something like 17 missions in all, that they sent from Japan to Chang'an. Often they had three or four ships at one time, and maybe a couple hundred people. A lot of those people on the ships were concerned just about the maintenance of the ship and getting enough food and other kind of facilities for the ship. But a small number were involved in negotiating and then in trying to understand. And in the year of 593, when Empress Suiko came to power, there was, at that time in Japan, the ruling structure was roughly 30 clans of large family groups and relatives that maybe several hundred people. And the ruling structure was kind of links between those 30 clans. They had various ways of getting along with each other. And what Princess Suiko, Empress Suiko, had in mind, and she used her nephew Shoto Taishi as part of this, was to try to build a broader administrative structure that went beyond a single clan. She had greater ambitions and wanted to extend her clans and the broader structure to a broader administrative structure. And when you look at it that way, it begins to pull together a lot of the individual things they were learning from China. At the time, the intellectuals of the day were Buddhist monks. And the Buddhist monks would, of course, learn to bring in Buddhism, but they had broader intellectual interests. And sometimes when the ship went to China, one of the Buddhist monks would stay and come back with the next ship. So for 15, 18, 20 years, between the ships, they would stay and they learned an awful lot. They learned so many things about China. So what are some of the basic kind of things that they learned during the course of this study? One was the written language. Before 600, there were occasional Chinese words that came in, and archaeologists who've been digging in Japan have found a few in funeral pyres where they dig out, they find a few bronze and other kind of implements where there were a few words, but there was no written language, there was no organized language. And there is a professor at Columbia named Lurie who's been tracing the development of the early Japanese language. And what he notes in this is that it came in different spurts in different localities, but then there was an effort during this period between 600 and 838 to try to have a unified language and to have a written language. And of course, since Japanese spoken language was completely different, there were various ways of matching the language. One was of taking the meaning of a picture and trying to duplicate the meaning. The other was by sound. And so there were various ways of trying to organize the written Japanese language. But basically, after 600, as part of this early mission of learning from China, the Japanese beginning to have a written language. Is it was important not only if you're going to have a broader geographical area to have something that people can communicate with another part. If you want to send out officials from one locality and have contact, particularly before they had telephones and rapid communication, if you're going to have some miles away and you want to have some kind of communication, and you also begin to need rules and some kind of regulations. So in Japan, over the next century, Taiko reforms and so forth, they began to introduce certain kind of regulations, certain kind of rules that would be, for example, for collecting taxes. because as you had a broader administrative region, you need to have some way of getting incomes and also some labor requirements so that they people would contribute to the nation, and also for getting young men to serve in the military. And so you had rules and regulations that were unified by word and begin to have that communication coming in from different localities. In the days of when the clans were in charge of Japan, there was no capital city. The sort of the center of the government would move from one clan to another as one place took the place of another and became more powerful. But when they began to introduce these new ideas and wanted a single location for the center of the activities, it took a while to build this up. And so they developed first the city of Nara, and they laid out Nara very much as Chang'an was laid out. Chang'an had numbered streets. The palace was in the north, and then there were cross streets on kind of a grid location. And Nara was laid out exactly on that. In 710, it was completed, and they began to have that as a capital city. And then some of the people who were leaders in the government later in that century felt the Buddhists in that area were beginning to have too much control. So they moved the capital, the Heian administration was Kyoto. And Kyoto, if you go to Kyoto now, you still have those numbered streets just as laid out from Chang'an, copied exactly from Chang'an. You had the temple in the north, the palace in the north, and you had temples on the side and various structures very much laid out on Chang'an. Fortunately at that time, the people in charge of the Sui dynasty, and later when the Tang came to power in 618 and defeated the Sui, the Tang were confident enough of their own power that they were happy to train officials from Japan. It reminds me, in the United States, it's a funny kind of analogy, but when the Japanese came over in the 1950s to learn about our automobile industry, we were so confident and so proud, we would show them all kinds of places. 30 years later, we were a little more secretive. But at the time, when Japan started learning from China, China was so confident, they were a bigger power, the distance was so great, but they were quite happy, and they wanted to have relationship with the peripheral tribes or civilizations or whatever that were peaceful, and there were sometimes called tribute relationships with some of the countries, but they were happy to have Japanese come and learn from them. So they were quite willing to help the Buddhists. Also, there was the introduction of Buddhism. And in China, Buddhism, in some ways, it was not just a practicing local religion, it was the links to the heavens. And the word Tianhuang, the emperor, was linked to the heavens and had kind of a special relationship with the heavens, which gave a legitimacy to the government. And so when the Japanese began to learn about this, their word was Tenno. But Ten is also that same character for heavens. And it was Buddhism that gave legitimacy by links with the national, natural surroundings to the local government. And Buddhism played that function as well as having a function for individual practitioners and the relation between life and death. It also had that link to the broader heavens. And then Confucianism also was a way of teaching loyalty, the younger brother to the older brother, and then to the Lord. And so it was a political philosophy that was very good for the government to teach to the people, that would provide a kind of a comprehensive picture. The Chinese had, by that time, had dynastic history, where the new dynasty would write their own history. And one of the functions of that local history was to provide legitimacy to show why the current dynasty was associated with the good, and all the people they defeated were associated with evil. That may be a kind of an overly simplified way of looking at dynastic history, but I think it had that function. It always glorified the current people in power. And so that was the writing of dynastic history. And the Japanese, after they began settling from China, they had the Kojiki and Nihon Shoki, which were their ways of developing their own kind of link with history. And the Japanese culture by that time gave a little more emphasis to heredity than Chinese culture through the clans, which was very central to the Japanese structure. And so when they created their books tracing back their history, and of course there had been somewhat of an oral tradition before they began writing their history after they had the contact with Chang'an, but as they began to introduce their oral history and put it down, they traced their roots all the way back to Jimmu Tenno, who came from the heavens and came down to earth, and they did the Chinese one further of linking it all the way to heavens to settling on earth, and that became the Japanese legitimation underlying the imperial system. The amazing thing to me is that all that way of thinking, or I could add more things, for example, architecture. The great temples of Kyoto were constructed during this period. And the people who developed those technology for building those temples, partly they came from Korea. Korea, of course, was in between. It was closer to Korea than Japan than some of the mainland China. And some of the knowledge of Japanese about China and going to China had come through Korea. And sometimes they would go directly. There were two main routes. But Koreans played a role in supplying some of the technicians, which they had learned from China. And so the Chinese temple architecture, one of the simple things that was introduced was that the old shrines at Issei that had been put up before the learning from China, they had the poles straight into the ground, but they rotted very quickly. And so every 20 years you'd have to change. And they also didn't have the kind of braces, the system for the broad arches that could support a larger area. And so they had to have straw roofs. They couldn't support a stronger, heavier roof. But by learning the new architecture from China, they could put the poles in cement or some kind of rock structure that would last much longer than putting it in the mud. So whereas in the Issei shrine, you had to have it renewed every 20 years, you could build large temples with broader architectural things, and those are also introduced in China. And also the court music in Japan, like the koto, those were basically Chinese instruments, and painting also came in from China. So the amazing thing to somebody like me who looks at all these things is the tiny number of people who are involved in spreading an entire civilization to a whole another civilization that became so important to the center of all Japanese civilization. Every, say, 15, 20 years, there might be 400 or 500 people who went. So over the course of a little more than two centuries, maybe 15, 20,000 people were involved. And as I estimated, the average number of people coming every day to Japan from China, last year there were over 8 million visitors, which means on the average were over 25,000 new people every day, which is probably more in one day than took place in 238 years.